Hello, Babylon 5 fans and Babylon podcast listeners. We are back with another speculative episode. I'm Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And Tim has questions, and I have questions. And hopefully we can come up with answers between ourselves, and who knows, maybe you guys can come up with answers. Gary, I'm so sorry I didn't give you enough lead time to call in voicemail messages for this. I will do better in the future.
I think the thing we need to understand is that we will have answers. Whether any of our answers are even remotely correct to what the future may hold, it remains to be seen. That's definitely a true thing here. But I do have questions and I do have thoughts. And I think it's worth taking the time to engage in some rampant, unfounded speculation.
I am a fan of rampant unfounded speculation, especially where our favorite show comes into play. Now that we are getting more of our favorite show, and your question, your theory was
my hypothesis.
Hypothesis. There you go. Was very, very intriguing.
So here's what sort of prompted this. I stumbled across the official J. Michael Straczynski capsule bio for this coming up San Diego Comic-Con. And it says, just when you thought the plague was over, J. Michael Straczynski returns to SDCC. JMS is the Hugo, Inkpot, Eisner icon, and Saturn Award-winning creator, writer for Babylon 5 and the upcoming B5 reboot for the CW, and Sense8. Wrote the Oscar-nominated Changeling, for which he received a British Academy Award nomination, worked on such movies as WWZ and Thor, and has written 400-plus comics for Marvel, DC, Image, and others. He created the Resistance Shared Universe for AWA, is writing two audio drama series for Penguin Random House, and has two new films slated for production in 2023. So here's my question. Mm-hmm. Along with this, Joe is also mentioned in the past about his eyesight trouble. And I don't know where it stands with that. The last I read, and this was a year or so ago, that it was difficult for him to spend long time sitting in front of a computer doing writing. Still, he's going to do it. That's without question. This capsule bio indicates that he's a very busy man, which brings me to the question. Let's assume that B5 reboot does go to series. Does JMS write every episode like he very nearly did on the original B5? Or do they employ a writer's room like every series on television seems to do these days?
Did they have an official writer's room?
Well, if you think of it as a room where, if you think of it as a room where a writer sat and wrote, then yes, they did. It's the office that JMS had where he sat down and wrote. No, from how I recall everything that I've read, after the second season where they employed outside writers to provide some scripts, JMS wrote everything up until Neil Gaiman wrote Day of the Dead. And part of that, by his own admission, was he knew where he wanted the story to go. And how do you offload that information to other writers to write those stories to get where you wanted to go, right?
Yeah, because he set some sort of record by writing most of, what is it, season 2, all of season 3, all of season 4, and again, a lot of season 5.
With one exception, right. He wrote, what, like 119 episodes, 120 episodes? Yeah, it's completely unheard of. By his own admission, it aged him, right? Take a look at a photo of J. Michael Straczynski when they're getting ready to shoot The Gathering, and then look at him as he's turning off the lights on the station. And that's not to be judgmental. It's just he did so much on that show.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. That's a lot of work.
And he's not as young as he was. And given that little capsule bio, he's busy doing other things, mm-hmm. right? I got to tell you, I can't see how he does it without having a writer's room.
Was there an official writer's room for season one? Like for television,
not that,
that as we know it, as we've seen writer's rooms in other series?
I don't think the writers, I could be wrong. In fact, I know I'm wrong. Because I did some reading, you know, just to kind of get myself up to speed. Writer's rooms had existed on other series prior to B5, clearly. From everything I recall reading from JMS's memoirs, if you will, in the script books and what's in Becoming Superman, I don't think they had a writer's room like we think of as a writer's room. Hmm. I think what he had were trusted writers who pitched stories, or trusted writers that he reached out to say, hey, can you, like David Gerald, he reached out to David Gerald and said, hey, I want you to write this story, right? And Gerald did. Mm-hmm. I think it was the same thing for Dorothy Fontana, the same kind of idea. And of course, with Larry DiTillo, who he had worked with on, you know, Captain Power and Jason the Wheeled Warriors and other things, right? So these were writers that he knew. But that's a lot different than what we think of as a writer's room, where it's a group of writers that sit together, hash out what are the stories they're going to tell for the season, and then assign scripts, scenes, whatever it is that they go and do, and then bring them back to the showrunner, who goes yes, yes, no, yes, no, yes, yes, right? Mm-hmm. So, and again, as we've sort of mentioned a million times already, after the second season, it's just JMS and his typewriter.
Right. So we speculate who gets to pick the writers that would be in that writer's room, how many people whose careers were influenced by the storytelling of Babylon 5 raise their hand and say, yeah, I'd like to be staffed on the writer's room for the new Babylon 5. And what is he looking for people who could share, to use a Star Trek metaphor, to share his mind meld for his vision for the show?
Well, that's a good question. And it does. Part of it is also dependent upon the kinds of stories he wants to tell in the new B5. He's made it very clear that it won't simply just be rehashing what the let's say the first series mm-hmm. was all about. And that leads me to a whole other question, which is, what do you do for a reboot? And we can come circling around to that here in a moment.
We would be stuck in that time becomes a loop thing forever.
Yes. Infinite regression. Uh-huh. Yeah. Recursive discussion. So anyways, but B5 was such a singular vision. And as much as we talk about, and let's face it, the gold standard is Star Trek for science fiction television. It just is. But as much as we talk about with Star Trek, how Gene Roddenberry had this amazing vision for the future, the fact remains that Gene guided it, but it was other people like Dorothy Fontana and Gene Kuhn and others who actually crafted what that world ended up looking like and being like, right? He may have had final say to say, yeah, that's good. That's not, you know, this is where we want to go. And of course, it's legendary or notorious now that the first few seasons on Next Generation, the writers found themselves handicapped because Gene said, well, these are more enlightened people, so they're not going to have interpersonal conflicts. And then the writers are going, okay, well, then what stories do we tell, right? Mm-hmm. But but that changes, you know, and without getting into that history, the fact is that changes because the showrunners in charge of Next Generation, Gene retiring, they managed to shift where those stories were going, right? But there's still sort of a collective vision. Babylon 5 is such a singular vision that, I mean, maybe that's part of what JMS is looking for, is to, rather than try to do it all himself, he wants to know what happens when you open up this particular universe to a number of other people and how they interpret it and the stories they want to tell with it.
Find the stories around the edges that other people can tell that enhance the world we've become familiar with.
Right. It's clear he doesn't. I wonder if it will be in some ways similar to Crusade, not in terms of the specific stories, but the fact that the B5 station was a secondary location for stories to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I wonder if that's the kind of thing that will happen there. Again, rampant speculation. But my concern becomes, again, back to Star Trek and their writers' rooms. The season 4 of Discovery, I will put my geek card on the line. Season 4 of Discovery is one of the best seasons of Star Trek ever made.
Wow. Okay, then.
Season 2 of Picard is one of the most ungodly train wrecks I've ever witnessed. What's the difference in those writers? And they are writers' rooms, right? So somewhere, and as much as I'm a fan of Discovery, Discovery has been very uneven in the first 3 seasons. But season 4, it's like it all came together. Everything was firing on all cylinders. The stories were great. The characters were great. It's like it all came together and everything fed back to the main story of what was going on. By comparison, Picard had so many ideas in it, and it didn't feel like anybody was sitting there going, that's a great idea, but that's not really what this story is about. And so it just ends up like it's, you've got this giant stack of index cards that have shuffled around. And then at the end, it kind of has a closure, but does it really, you know, so maybe it would be different with JMS being a showrunner, where he's not necessarily writing a script, but he's overseeing what everybody else is writing. And he gets to say, okay, guys, I'm sitting here, I'm hearing what you're saying. These are great ideas, but this isn't what B5 is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take this, do a thing. You know, similar to like what he did with the three trilogies.
Hmm.
You know, the Technomage trilogy.
Yeah, yeah, the books.
Right, yeah, exactly. And he just said, here's the outline, do the thing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And for those listeners out there who have no idea the kind of work that goes into showrunners planning and collaborating with a writer's room, there's a documentary out there that for a while was on Netflix. I don't think it's there anymore. It's called Showrunners. And they are actually going around to different shows talking about different things that are happening in those writers' rooms. I think they're working on like one of the last seasons of Bones. There's the writers' room for Spartacus with Steven DeKnight, who's brilliant, by the way. There's like the final season of what's that? Oh, there was a sitcom or a dramedy on TNT or TBS with Ray Romano and I'm drawing a blank on his name. He was in Homicide: Life on the Streets. He was in Brooklyn 9-1-1. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not familiar.
Yeah, there's totally drawing a blank. Anyway. The Showrunners is an excellent documentary if you can find it. And these, the guys making this movie were in these writers' rooms watching the process of these showrunners and these writers on several different shows. Some of them were broadcast TV. Some of them were basic cable. Some of them were pay cable. That Don Cheadle series where they were lawyers, fixers, or whatever. They went into the first season of that. And that's a fascinating documentary. And if you ever want to see the managed chaos of how a showrunner herds the cats in a writer's room, that is a very good place to start. Yes, I recommend it highly. And now that I think about it, Sense8 didn't actually have a real writer's room either, did it?
I have to admit, I'm not familiar enough with the show to know.
Actually, I don't know who wrote the episodes for the seasons that we got, but I thought it was just JMS and the Wachowskis.
Well, they certainly produced it. Here's the cast, more cast and crew. Let's see what this has to say. Series writing credits. J. Michael Straczynski, 24 episodes. Lana and Lily Wachowski. Alexander Heyman gets one episode, and David Mitchell gets one episode.
Okay, I guess that answers that question.
And there isn't even a little arrow to click down to see more. So that's pretty much it right there.
Okay.
But again, I come back to the fact that, you know, JMS is older. You might even say wiser. I would be very surprised if he tried to do that all again at that level he did.
Mm-hmm. And as you were saying, like his vision, can't call it loss. I guess it's vision deterioration, decline.
Yeah.
David Weber is a very accomplished science fiction author. I believe he's a grandmaster, a Sifwa grandmaster.
Mm-hmm.
He has been dictating his novels for at least 20 years. He has a collaborator, a guy he worked with on his last, Out of the Dark and Into the Light. Basic overview, aliens come to invade Earth and Earth is protected by the vampires. So,
okay.
It's a very, very well-written series. The story premise is like, they did what? Oh, that's different. And the aliens are so not prepared for the vampires. It's kind of funny. Those two books were written with a collaborator, but David Weber has been dictating his novels for, like I said, 20 years and maybe more. I just know for certain it's 20. And maybe that's something. If it comes to the point where JMS has no patience for screen time with the strain on his eyes, I forget the name of the software David Weber uses. It might be Drag and Dictate. It might be. But yeah, he uses software to dictate his novels. Kevin J. Anderson records his writing audio. He goes for long walks out in the mountains and he is talking out the prose he's going to, polish later. So now I'm getting an image of a crowd of microphones being held by Babylon 5 ingenues recording every word that comes out of JMS's.
Yeah, right.
Oh my goodness. I have no idea what goes on in there.
Yeah, I'm looking here at the Wikipedia entry for Sensate, and it basically confirms what IMDb said. So first season, Wachowskis and Straczynski split the number of scripts in half and worked remotely from each other, but with frequent meetings. Writing for the second season was performed by Lana and Straczynski by collaborating inside a shared writer's room. David Mitchell, who wrote Cloud Atlas, and novelist columnist Alexander Heyman worked as additional writers in the second season and credited as consultants. And what it says is here, they were basically regularly tasked by Lana Wachowski to write from a distance, select scenes on short deadlines that she and Straczynski would further develop or reject. So that's the closest they've got to a writer's room, as we think of a traditional writer's room. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Okay.
So,
well, it'll be interesting to see where they go with it. I would love to interview some of the writers for the new series once they're in place, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I wouldn't want to talk about actual plots, just how that melting pot of a room works for story pitches, for collaborating, for cleaning up each other's work, because that happens in writer's room from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And
go ahead.
No, I was going to say the idea of freelance one-offs like Day of the Dead intrigues me. And I had I had this wild idea, because every series, well, I shouldn't say every series, but most sci-fi or fantasy related series that I have indulged in, some of them have had very successful musical episodes, some haven't. And I started thinking about what sort of one-off wackiness could happen. And around the same time I was thinking about that, I came across the latest book in the Shakespeare pop culture series, which was Shakespeare's The Avengers, which came out last October, which I had no idea existed. The same author, Ian Dosher, I believe that's how his last name is pronounced. If it's not, I'm sorry. I will fix that when I actually do talk to him. Started out 10 years ago or so with doing Shakespearean translations of the original Star Wars trilogy.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. He did more. He did the prequel trilogy. He did the sequel trilogy. He did Clueless. Taming of the Clueless is what it's called. He's done Back to the Future and a couple of others ones. And I'm like, I missed the Avengers one. How did I miss these? How? And he apologized to me on Twitter and said he'd make sure I get the next memo. But I began to wonder, what would happen if an episode of Babylon 5 was done in iambic pentameter? And I don't know why my brain thought of it, but that thought got in my brain and didn't leave. So I was like, yeah, that'd work better than a musical.
Although a musical would be fun.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, think about it. Londo's story is a Shakespearean tragedy. His entire arc is a Shakespearean tragedy. So yeah, having a random Shakespearean themed episode, I think that would be hilarious. And there's precedent because, as we know from the movies, Shakespeare is best enjoyed in the original Klingon.
Or the original Drazi.
I would have to go Narn. I would have to go Narn with that. Mozart would have been Centauri, Shakespeare would have been Narn.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you that. Although I think there's something to be saying. What color is the scarf we see before me? Is it green or is it purple?
Nice.
That's about as iambic as it's gonna get. Yes.
That would be fun. Having
Drazi. Who knew the old man had so much Vorlon within him?
Oh, having a Drazi theater troupe perform their interpretation of Shakespearean Narn. Dude.
Yes.
Dude. Oh my God. That has to happen. That has to happen.
Yes.
And like I said, I own a copy of that college sophomore English class, the Shakespeare class, that big red book, The Complete Works of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I know somebody who literally threw her back out, almost dislocated her shoulder, because she had the audacity to carry that Shakespeare book, a physics book, and a chemistry book in her same book bag at the same time. I'm like, are you insane? Why? What possessed you to do that? Anyway,
she a power lifter now?
I don't know, but it was funny. But I have mentioned this before, I think. I know I've mentioned it on Slice of Sci-Fi. I don't know if I've mentioned it here, but I found a book in a used bookstore that was The Complete Works of Shakespeare, annotated by Isaac Asimov.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And when I first saw it, I'm like, wait, what? I mean, to me, that's like, you know, finding out that that Galileo annotated Nostradamus.
That one I don't know about, Asimov annotated everything. So,
but yeah, no, I'm sitting here going, Isaac Asimov took the time to annotate The Complete Works of Shakespeare. Where did he find the time? And it's a fascinating book.
Uh huh.
So yeah, there's that. So if Asimov can take the time to study and break down Shakespeare, why not JMS or someone who he appoints to that task?
Well, I think that it would be fun to see a lighthearted episode like that. It would go over better than Rebo and Zooty, I can tell you
that. You're never going to let that go, are you?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm thinking, a Babylon 5 version of Twelfth Night in Shakespearean, in iambic pentameter.
Yes. I'd go for a musical. I think that would be awesome.
Hmm.
Maybe not a musical like Joss Whedon did on Buffy, you know, where they were all cursed with
blown musical, yeah.
Yeah, right. But something where, you know, again, the idea of a troupe, or how about a race that comes on and they sing to communicate. And so
kind of like that Star Trek episode where that race talked in metaphor.
Force, yes, yes. but everything is in a song, and then the crew figures, well, if we're going to make this diplomatic process works, we've got to start writing our own tunes, you know, and it could go from, you know, really beautiful to horribly atrocious and everything in between. I think that would be a ton of fun.
You have
contact
situation where the new race being encountered, they perform on stage for all their diplomatic discussions, negotiations.
Yes. I, you know, and one of the things that I think Babylon 5 did really well is they did balance humorous situations with the dramatic situations. And I think that JMS did it with a fairly deft hand. There's a couple times where it's a little clunky, maybe. But for the most part, it all seemed to work. None of it really felt terribly out of place, with exceptions, but we've already hashed that out. But hey, my point is, Neil Gaiman wrote
lines for Rebo and Suti to say that made Mira Furlan crack up. It is worth it to see her laughing like that, totally losing it. Come on. That's pure joy on Delenn's face there.
Yes. Yes, it is. I won't deny that. However, I think Captain Lockley's expression was more suitable for the situation. Having said that, no, I don't want to rehash that. That's not my point.
Not gonna argue.
No, my point is that, yeah, I think, you know, when JMS says there are things that he has learned and this is the opportunity for him to take what he's learned in the last 20 some years of writing and producing, to use those experiences and tools, his words, to bring them back to Babylon 5, I could certainly see some of that. Maybe that's part of it, right? Mm-hmm. That he recognizes, yeah, that we can do more stuff that is a little looser, or maybe a little more fun or funny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's all, I mean, again, this is all speculation.
Rampant, wild, just out of the box, over deep left center field and the farm beyond it. Speculation, because we are obsessed with the show. We love the show and we want more of it and we can't wait.
Give it to me. Although, again, you know, the thing is, a B5 pilot has been rolled over to the 2023 production season, mm-hmm. which is, you know, unprecedented in a sense that, you know, when there was the purchase of the CW and the new people came in, that they didn't just wipe out the slate of the previous peoples and we're going with our own stuff. Somebody went to bat for the show to say, we're still interested in having it done. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, until we get an announcement that a cast has been signed and they're on a soundstage shooting the first scene of the pilot, I got to tell you, I'll believe it when I see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not getting my hopes up so high that they will be dashed if and when an announcement comes out to say, yeah, we've decided to go in a different direction.
Hmm. Yep, that works.
You know, I mean, yep. that's the nature of it, and I'm old and cynical that way, I guess.
Oh, any other thoughts?
No, the only other thought I have is what the nature of a reboot might look like.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we could literally speculate on that all night.
Yes, exactly. Maybe we need to do a whole other show about that because I do have thoughts.
Well, we covered some of it in the episode we did back in October.
Yeah, that's true.
So we can cover more. Or we can have Gary and Edmund weigh in and answer their questions.
John from Jersey, absolutely.
Yeah.
We should get that. That's the thing. Let's get those three on and let's just have a round table.
Ooh. Hmm.
Yeah.
That could be that
or
could
a
be
long
plan.
Table like they had in the council chambers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with the big tall Macintosh chairs we could sit in.
Yeah, we could do that. so we're gonna try to make this a semi-regular thing. Yep. Probably do something in another, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, who knows?
Yep.
Maybe sooner if new news surfaces. But you can find us at BabylonPodcast.com. Come on by. We have 290 other episodes you can check out. I am in the process of upgrading, or I guess the word is resizing, improving the old videos that Jeffrey had recorded. And I'm going to take them out of the podcast feed, but put them on YouTube. So they're going to be high def versions of what he'd recorded. They're going to not take up space in the podcast, because who goes to podcasts or video anymore?
Not me.
Not a lot of people. They're like, that's what YouTube's for. Yeah, I know. You said,
Yeah.
So those changes will be coming to the feed eventually. And yes, if you can go to Babylon Podcast on Twitter. I do chime in with the conversations every now and then. I retweet a lot of Mars-related news because Mars.
Yeah.
Three times it's tried to kill me. I post a lot of space news and Mars news and Lego Star Wars news, because some of those Lego kits for Star Wars ships are amazing. And
I really
would love to see them do a Babylon 5 related Lego sets, because if they did, I know those would be way, way silly, stupid, expensive, but I would want to buy them anyway.
I saw a photo in a book about Lego of a model of the station that somebody had built that was like 6 feet long.
No.
It was immense and it was gorgeous. And it's not a kit. It's somebody who just put it all together, because, oh my God, that thing would probably be $3,000.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, that they came out with a new Star Destroyer. I think I don't even know what the price of that is. It's ridiculous. Large Lego stuff. But yeah. And the folks over at Hero Collector, I don't know if you've seen any of their things.
Actually, I have. They're gorgeous.
Their Battlestar Galactica ships are perfect, I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. They keep selling out of, like, the original series Galactica and the original series Cylon base ship, but I have them. I have the original series. I have the original series Viper, and I have the new series Viper. I think it's the Mark IIs and the Mark VIIs.
Oh, nice.
And they are gorgeous. And they have a series, what they call their XL series.
Uh-huh.
And there's a gold-plated, I think it's an Enterprise. That
gold
is
plated.
Gorgeous. Yeah. And these things are like 10 to 14 inches long. They have a new XL sized Firefly, the Serenity ship that will be coming out in a few weeks, that I pre-ordered in December. And I think they sold out of them for a while, but I think the three dragons from Game of Thrones are back in stock. One of them literally has like a 10-inch wingspan. It might be bigger. I don't know if it's 10 inches or 12 inches, but still, it's very, very good models of Daenerys's dragons. And they have a whole slew of Star Trek ships and Orville ships, Space 1999 ships.
Nice.
And their books are gorgeous. If you get the Battlestar Galactica Shipyards book, you will not be disappointed. If you get the Star Trek Next Generation and Star Trek DS9 Shipyards
and
books.
Actually, any of those Shipyard books are fantastic.
They are.
And they have a Humble Bundle going on right now,
what?
I think. Yeah, because I downloaded a bunch of the Star Trek stuff that was... a couple of the Shipyard books that I already have, but that's okay. But
like PDF versions or?
Yeah, PDF versions, right. Not print versions. These are all PDF stuff. Nice. But still, you know,
it's great reference material to have.
Yeah. Yeah, and exactly.
I interviewed those guys, I think it was in December, saying, hey, would you ever do Babylon 5? And one of the guys was like, hell yes. So who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe more marketing savvy CW team, they can hand out licenses to Hero Collector to give us small and large ships, because that would be glorious.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I would spend the big money on B5 Hero Collector ships. Yeah. Yes.
So
absolutely.
Hero Collector and Lego, if you're listening, Babylon 5 toys for all, please.
So okay, really quick, as a speculation, maybe one of the things that JMS has learned that he wants to put into his toolbox is to go ahead and merchandise the hell out of the show from the beginning. Yeah, just do it. Spaceships.
Is that his call?
It was, as I recall, it was back in the original series. They wanted to put out like action figures and things, and he told them no because he felt like that would be constraining the story. That if there was an action figure of Jakar, would either give something away or people would say, hey, but the action figure shows this and now you're doing the thing. That's what I recall. And maybe that's something that's changed, because I think
we did get action figures eventually,
but
small
not,
and large ones.
But not until well into the show's production.
Yeah.
And not the kind of, you know, the Micro Machines were really groovy, but you know, they're only but so good. Mm-hmm. You know, they were nice to have. I loved having them. Don't get me wrong, but they weren't like the Hero Collector stuff.
They weren't
gorgeous.
The Revell model kits for Monogram.
Yeah, those were good too. But that's my point, right? Is let's just go ahead and license the shit out of it. Let's just give me the toys. Give me the books.
Mm-hmm.
Give me the thing.
Oh,
it's okay.
A Shipyard's books for Babylon 5. Oh
yes.
My God.
Yes.
Oh my God. I'm there.
Yeah.
I'd do the sit outside the doors in the rain, waiting for concert tickets to go on sale kind of thing.
Summer, what you'd have to do is sit online in your room,
mm-hmm.
and then just click the pre-order button.
Hey, you have
now,
not
I mean, it's
lived.
A different world. It's all a different world now from when B5 first came on. That's my whole point here.
Yeah, I know. I'm old. I waited in line 2.5 days to get Prince tickets once, so hush.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's well worth it at that point.
Oh, goodness gracious. So, yeah, head on over to Babylon Podcast on Twitter and let us know if toys and books are something you're looking forward to wanting to spend money on. Because I think if we drum up interest now, just a little trickle of stuff every now and then,
yeah.
I think that would help. Oh, I need to find out who to talk to over at the CW, because I have questions. I have suggestions. I don't want to make a nuisance of myself. And I promise I will not do any story pitching. I just have questions for peripheral B5 stuff.
Yeah.
For those of you who want to join Gary and Edmund in leaving voicemail messages, you can call 602-635-6976, leave a voicemail, and we will include them in the next episode. And who knows, if we get enough feedback, enough questions from either email, website, or voicemail, maybe we could have a feedback show.
Yes.
I think that'd be fun.
Me too.
We still don't have an official intro and outro to these interim shows, but see you in a few months with more speculation, because that's what we're here for.
It's what we do. We'll be right back.